from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations and comments featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. The origins and shape of politics in the modern American South provide rich sources for scholarship and social criticism. In the first of two discussions, Soundings now examines the history and development of politics in the American South. The panelists in the following portion of the conversation are Dewey Grantham, George Tyndall, William Havard, and Edwin Yoder. Dewey Grantham and William Havard are professors at Vanderbilt University. Professor Grantham recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a book entitled 20th Century Southern Politics, The History of an American Institution. George Tyndall is a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Edwin Yoder served as editorial page editor at the Washington Star and now writes a syndicated column for the Washington Post Writers Group. Dewey, let me ask you to comment on what might be called the industry of the South, the interest in the South in novels and film, scholarship, from your particular vantage point as a historian.
Well, in the first place, Wayne, I think you're right that it is a thriving industry, certainly a thriving period of research and writing in dealing with the American past. Indeed, I don't know of any more dynamic aspect of American history than the current investigation of the South. Why it is poses a very profound and complicated complex question, and it does seem to me that politics represents perhaps the major manifestation of Southern distinctiveness. In other words, if you're going to try to compare this region with other parts of the country, its political behavior and thought perhaps represent as tangible and meaningful a way of getting at that distinctiveness as any. I think we'd all agree that the South's sectionalism, its political expression of its differentness from the rest of the country, is a very powerful and sustained aspect of the region's history.
George Tyndall?
Stephen Potter, who is the guru of one-upmanship, said that the way you can confound any broad generalization that anybody makes is that you look thoughtful for a moment and you say, yes, but not in the South. And I think there's a perception both in the South and outside the South that the South is Uncle Sam's other province. It's a strange land and a peculiar people. It's a rather bizarre place to a lot of people outside the South, and to some inside the South, I think. And there are a number of things besides its politics that account for differences. The South was an agrarian region longer than most of the country. It has had for much longer time a biracial population. It has tended to be a more religious and a peculiar, a different sort of way, I should say. It has a more Native American population, both white and black. And of course, during the era of the Solid South, given the disfranchisement that prevailed, blacks were not active in politics to any degree. That has now changed, and I think in the present day South, since about 1952, well, actually 1948 with the Dixiecrat campaign was when it began to change. In 1952, Eisenhower made the first breakthrough since Hoover's breakthrough in 1928, but his proved to be the beginning of a continuing republicanism, first a presidential Republicanism, but gradually getting down to the congressional level and even to more local levels in many places, although I don't think we can say that the two-party system is firmly established yet.
We forget sometimes how late the real self-consciousness about the race issue came to the South, because slavery was introduced almost by accident. In since the first slaves came from a Dutch trader, and they came in as indentured servants. But within a generation, they had enslaved these people in Virginia and made it legal.
Now that occurred
by the middle of the 17th century.
Yeah.
It became legal in Virginia. 1619 was the date when the first blacks came to America. So you can see why it's often claimed that that we have two indigenous intervening, that is from the standpoint of the Indians, ethnic or racial groups in this society. And so you have to start with that. Now, there was becoming a self-consciousness about this in the Jeffersonian period. You remember Jefferson was very much in favor of repatriation of blacks as a solution to the problem. And he said he didn't think the two races could be assimilated, largely on civilizational grounds. And his figure of speech was, we have the wolf by the ears. In other words, we can't let the wolf go. And people thought for a time, but then what happened? Eli Whitney came along and got into our gin. And this opened up the frontier of the Deep South, where the soil was suitable for cotton production. So this is a very old story, and it goes back a long way. Then, of course, between 1830 and 1860, you got Fitzhugh and all the other slave justifiers, the creation of the first of the big Southern myths of why they were a different culture. And when you look at Jefferson, you see a vast difference there. Jefferson, of course, is usually attributed to the Enlightenment, but we must not forget that Jefferson also was an aristocrat, in a sense, that he was an agrarian, but he believed in and advocated, of course, a natural aristoi, is what his educational system and other things wanted to develop. But he never did have a real place for the black man, even though he wanted to exclude slavery in his first draft of the Declaration of Independence. But this attitude has persisted to some extent. If you want to see democracy at the local level of the type that was conceived by Jefferson and other people really in action, you go into Mississippi, even today, to some of the rural counties, and look at where they still have all the administrative structures decentralized, where everything gets down to person, family, and there may be 200 registered voters, and the election may turn on 95 to 100 with five people abstaining, and all the school bus drivers, all the road workers, and other people will depend on the election of those county people. And this is the way the South conducted its politics for a long time. It was poor. It had very little to share in the public sense, and most of it was farmed out pretty much on that basis. And that's why the South had excitement in politics, but little visibility at the larger levels.
I think Bill has touched on another critical and subtle historical point, which is that in some southern states, it was assumed by the sort of middling class of white people, whether their sympathies were populist or Republican or what have you, that the very influential farmers and planters could control to some great degree through economic coercion the black vote and use it as a sort of make weight against their own interests. And this was a very important impetus towards disfranchisement in a number of Southern states. The term racism as such, I think, is a very tricky and some to some degree not very useful term in the analysis of the history of Southern politics, because in many instances, as in this one, one can find that essentially racist theories and explanations were offered ex post facto to justify what amounted to acts of political power, the seizure of political power for essentially economic self-interest. Bill, would you agree to that? I think that's maybe a development of a point you were making there.
Yes. Remember that the South was like the blacks over a long period. They were under attack, although for quite different reasons. They felt defensive. They were sequestered for long, partly by their own choice, but partly by the continuous pressures of the South, symbolized by the fact that you couldn't elect a president from the South for so long. You see, it's very much the case that you get an intermingling, almost impossible to separate, of this justificatory myth-building. George has urged us many times to study the South from the standpoint of the myths. And I take it he means both the realities and the convenient fictions. The practice of politics is, as Ed has pointed out, really the practice of compromise, the practice of accommodation, making of alignments based on commonalities of interests. And this is very complex. It's almost a miracle that we've managed to sustain a two-party system nationwide in this country. And as you know, many people feel that the parties are threatened nationally now with breaking down into interest groups that are so isolated from each other, and a return to a sort of closed ideological politics, which the South practiced in the days when every time you started to raise real issues and draw in coalitions of whites and blacks and other people to move toward a sort of class politics, and I wouldn't want to see that occur absolutely either. But you could almost interpret what has been said here earlier as saying that the element of race is still there, but it's now become, through the active participation of blacks, a sort of dual racial component there, but with a lot of crossing over the lines. But there's a danger that with the headiness of political power, that the choice of black leadership could go also to extremists and lose that capacity to compromise, which most whites have still accepted. One of the things that I think is so important about the Reverend Martin Luther King and his great rhetorical ability based on principle in the proper Aristotelian sense is that he was simultaneously able to persuade the whites that their religious tradition, which was common with the black, that their religious tradition would not permit them to continue to behave in this way, while simultaneously warning the black population that he was leading that to engage in a futile revolution of violence would be to defeat the very purpose of both their religion and their civil rights. And I think that ability to practice politics in this way, still reserving some areas of choice in terms of having an identity as a member of a race or a minority or an ethnic group, but having that freedom to cross the line on a lot of other types of interests and a lot of other types of considerations, such as economic class and social class, such as cultural aspects that we have in common or that on which we differ in our whole relation to international affairs and every other issue that comes up. And I think Dewey is right. We have opened up enormous possibilities for cooperation. We have proved once again that in the South, those vestiges of personal relations with its localization and vast pluralism has had some advantages in enabling the South to adapt in some ways better to the new conditions. They would never have adapted unless they were forced on them. But there were elements in the subcultural aspects of the society that enabled the South to handle these problems, I think, somewhat better than the great northern cities with their abstraction and all the other things that we put down to.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to the first of two discussions about politics in the modern American South. The panelists are Dewey Grantham, William Havard, Edwin Yoder, and George Tyndall. Dewey Grantham and William Havard specialize in political history at Vanderbilt University. Professor Grantham recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a book about 20th century Southern politics. Edwin Yoder writes a syndicated column for the Washington Post Writers Group. George Tyndall is the author of books and articles about politics in the American South. He teaches at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
Let me ask you to comment on this proposition. Why is it important to categorize Southern politicians? It's not merely an academic exercise. It's not something that's useful simply to the historians. But why is it important that you break them into types and give them characteristics? And again, reflect on the difference between Southern politicians and politicians from other parts of the country.
Perhaps one response to that, Wayne, might be that since you couldn't separate them into Republicans and Democrats, you had to try to figure out what distinguished one Democrat from another. That's a very superficial response.
No, it's a good one.
I don't mind doing some separation of sheep and goats in recent Southern politics, bearing in mind that no one's judgment is infallible. But of course, the the poll star for any such distinction in my book, and you're not talking particularly, although in some cases you are, about the human qualities, the inmost human qualities of these people. You're again talking in operational terms about their effect, which was either constructive and to some degree moved the human enterprise forward a bit, and those whose effect was not constructive. I think we've had, fortunately, in public life, we've had a rather fortunate run of good Southern governors over recent years, and some of whom are still active in politics. You would have to mention the names of Luther Hodges and Terry Sanford and Linwood Holton and Reuben Askew and Carl Sanders and Jimmy Carter, both in Georgia, and many others of that sort. They are the ones who get good grades in my book, because it seems to me their influence was largely constructive. I don't really know how far I would want to go on the negative side, but surely people like George Wallace, at least in his earlier political incarnation, which has certainly changed rather drastically now, was rather unfortunate, although it can be argued, and I think the argument has been made, that George Wallace, by, for example, his resistance to the Selma March, which and other events which occurred contemporaneously in Alabama, could to some degree be called the architect and father, not the architect, but the father of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which we've already agreed and stipulated as a critical measure in the history of civil rights development. There have been others who took a good bit of interest in the development of Southern economic growth, which to some degree is independent of the race question. But I think the civil rights question has been so much the overwhelming question in this part of the country that my distinction between quote good and quote bad people would fall along those lines.
This same accusation of failure of leadership was laid at the door of the White House, too, that Eisenhower had his doubts about... he had this idea that first you've got to reach the hearts and minds before you can... You can't do this sort of thing by law. And therefore, he failed to speak out, and in fact, in private, expressed very serious doubts about the court decision in 54. I'd like to pursue, though, a little bit more this definition of the good leader. A good many years ago, Bill, I had a chance to interview Sam Rayburn when he was still Speaker of the House. And at that time, I was working on a book on the South in first half of the 20th century, and was interviewing him in connection with that. And I raised the question, given the significance of Southern leadership in Congress, whether there had been a conscious effort on the part of leaders to identify likely young men and put them in key committee positions. And his response to that was that he thought the reason that these that the reason they were so effective was this very primary system in the South, which he argued was really a very much a rough and tumble system, the kind of fragmented politics I referred to earlier, the politics of personalities. And he said when they get here, they've really been tested in the fires. And so it's only the strong personalities that manage to survive that.
They were majority in a minority party for a long time. Then when it became a majority party, they shifted over and cooperated with they were on a national scale a pretty good party people.
I'll take a shot at that, Bill. Yeah. I'm sure you know more about it than I do, but you I always think of Bill Fulbright in the election of 1946, if I'm not mistaken. President Truman lost control of Congress. And at that time, Bill Fulbright, who has always rather thought that our system of government needs reforming in the direction of the parliamentary system, suggested an elaborate scheme by which Mr. Truman might resign, and since there was no occupant of the vice presidency and the Speaker of the House then was next in line of succession, bring to office a Republican president who would then be a responsible chief of government. And Mr. Truman's response was that over-educated Oxford SOB, he's the best argument I know of for the land-grant college. To the minds of people like Truman and Johnson, there has always, I suppose, been something a bit hoity-toity about some of Bill Fulbright's ideas, although he himself is as you all know, a very, I wouldn't say earthy in the sense that Lyndon Johnson was known to be earthy, but certainly a very down-to-earth kind of person, by no means a pretentious or precious politician in the least. Turning to Lyndon Johnson, of course, here you have someone from the Texas Hill Country who I think was conscious, perhaps too conscious, throughout his political career of what he regarded as a deficiency of formal education. What Bill Fulbright had in great measure, Lyndon Johnson lacked or thought he lacked, and I think it was a vacuum in his background that bothered him a great deal, and to some degree troubled and complicated his relationship with people who could have been of service to them. But I think fundamentally of Fulbright and Johnson as people with an affinity, who truly transcended, although they had to start with the same kinds of political problems that all Southern politicians in the segregationist era started with, nonetheless managed to work their way around this handicap and achieve something of lasting and fundamental importance in both cases. And
don't you think, Ed, that one explanation of that is that they had or came to have truly national ambition?
Certainly, that is true of Lyndon Johnson. I don't really know whether Senator Fulbright entertained ambitions beyond the Senate or not at any time.
I mean, rendering national service, yes, and dealing, in his case, largely with foreign policy.
Well, certainly, Fulbright is a man whose scope and grasp of the issues was of international dimensions. Whether one subscribes entirely to his point of view about things or not, one would have to concede that he was a serious student of the world.
Don't forget that until World War II, and the shift back in the direction of the post-Reconstruction period thinking, the South had been the most international-minded part of the country. Partly that was based on the fact that it was an exporting company, area, natural resources, and so forth. And there was a sudden volte-face in that attitude, and that's gradually being built up again. And if you look back in this history of the period we've been talking about in the 20th century, you'll see that a lot of the leadership, Cordell Hull and even old Senator Tom Connally, and a lot of the people who were very important in our foreign policy, were Southerners all through that era. Just mentioned that in passing because we wanted to say something about the South in international politics, and up to now what we've said has made appear to be almost entirely negative.
Apropos of what you have just said, Bill, I think one point that has struck me as if you think about the things that Van Woodward says about the, in a sense, the un-Americanism of the South, the peculiar experiences of tragedy, social tragedy, having the experience of evil in the slavery system, the experience of defeat, the experience of poverty, all of these things being rather atypical in American history. This gives, it seems, has always seemed to me, gives the South a certain affinity with the rest of the world, because insofar as the rest of the United States has been exempted from these experiences, it, most of the rest of the world has certainly not been exempted from them, and to the degree that these are common experiences, it may have explained some of that affinity between the South and the world.
You've been listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond with the first of two discussions about politics in the modern American South. The panelists were Dewey Grantham and William Havard of Vanderbilt University, Edwin Yoder, a syndicated columnist for the Washington Post Writers Group, and George Tyndall of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Next week on Soundings, Professor John Hope Franklin of Duke University joins the panel for part two of the discussion about politics in the modern American South. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join me this week for the first of two discussions about politics in the American South. The origins and shape of Southern politics provide rich sources for scholarship and social criticism. Part one of the Soundings series surveys Southern political history and some of its major influences on regional and national culture. The panelists for Soundings include Dewey Grantham and William Havard of Vanderbilt University, George Tyndall of the University of North Carolina, and Edwin Yoder, a syndicated columnist for the Washington Post Writers Group. Politics in the American South, Part 1, this week on Soundings, from the National Humanities Center on this station.